This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
it's always a matter of being one step behind, but hopefully getting there quickly enough to prevent the disease from moving ahead, because it doesn't move that quickly if you can put some barriers in its way.
That's Stephen Morse, a professor of epidemiology, discussing the challenges of stopping the spread of Ebola. Details coming up.
Also, 6 months after it was sealed, Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea have reopened their borders, and 5 Kenyan police officers died this morning when they struck hit a bomb in the road near the Somalia border.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea have reopened their border 6 months after it was sealed to stop the movement of armed groups that fought to overthrow President Teodoro Obiang Nguema, who has led Equatorial Guinea since 1979. Moki Edwin Kinzico reports from the Equatorial Guinea border town of Ibabian that strict controls remain on movement across the border.
It is a busy Wednesday morning at the main bus station in Ibabian, a northeastern town in the part of Equatorial Guinea that is on the African mainland. Business persons from neighboring Cameroon and Gabon are transporting goods to and from the tiny Central African state. Ephraim Mukwa, a 43-year-old Cameroon-born truck driver, says they are happy Equatorial Guinea officials have finally authorized them to have access to Cameroon.
Les gens sont contents, les taximans sont avec les clients, les bus sont avec les personnes.
He says people are very grateful and happy as the town's taxi business is picking up and buses and trucks can now freely circulate between Cameroonian border towns right to Bata, the economic capital city of Equatorial Guinea. Cameroon supplies food items, building material and motor spare parts to Equatorial Guinea, while Equatorial Guinea delivers beverages and vegetable oil to Cameroon. 40-year-old Equatorial Guinean businesswoman Rosaline Ava says there has been a huge movement of goods and people to and from Ibabian within the past 2 weeks after Equatorial Guinea officials announced that the borders had been completely reopened. She says she is just returning from the first business trip to Cameroon in 5 months.
Vendredi passé, nous sommes entrés avec 9 camions. Nous avons fait 3 jours là-bas dedans parce que eux n'avaient.
She says they went to the Cameroonian border town of Kiosi with 9 trucks of wine, whiskies, and vegetable oil on Friday last week, with the hope of returning after 2 days. Instead, she says, they spent 3 additional days waiting for farm produce they bought from Cameroon to supply to their clients in the Equatorial Guinea border town of Ibabian and the country's economic capital, Bata. She says she is happy they are doing brisk business after a long period of no trading. Equatorial Guinea closed its border with Cameroon on December 24, following a failed coup attempt in the oil-rich Central African state. On December 29, Equatorial Guinea's leadership said its forces had arrested a number of people moving towards the Cameroon border in possession of rocket launchers, rifles, and a stockpile of ammunition. Officials alleged the group had accumulated the weapons to destabilize the government of President Teodoro Obiang Nguema, who has ruled the Spanish-speaking country since 1979 and is the longest-serving leader in Africa. His critics have historically characterized his government as authoritarian and corrupt. Henderson Kweton Konge, the highest-ranking government official in Tem Valley, Cameroon Border Administrative Unit, says the decision to reopen the border was taken following a series of meetings in which both countries agreed the threat to Obiangema's presidency had passed.
Progressively, serenity, peace, order and discipline reigns along the borders. So the Guinean authorities have judged for themselves that it was necessary to relax the exchanges. And we think that if it continues in this way, the barriers will completely uplifted.
2 months ago, the border was opened only 2 days every week, and movement was under strict control of the Equatorial Guinea military. But today, movement is allowed daily, with impromptu and spontaneous checks by the country's police force. Obiang, who celebrated his 76th birthday on Tuesday, was elected to a fifth seven-year term in 2016. In polls, the opposition said were rigged to his favor. Equatorial Guinea, a former colony of Spain, is a tiny oil-rich state with 1.2 million people. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Ibebiyin, Equatorial Guinea.
Kenyan officials say 5 police officers died this morning when their truck hit a bomb in the road near the Somali border. Harun Kamawa, the deputy country commissioner in the region, says the officers were on patrol in Liboy, a town near the border. Officials have not identified who planted the bomb, but there have been attacks in the area over the years blamed on the Al-Shabaab militant group in Somalia. Also today, Kenyan search and rescue workers, including a police helicopter, are battling poor visibility as they search for a small plane that disappeared off radar screens last night. The plane was en route to Nairobi from the western town of Kitale with the 8 passengers and 2 crew on board. It disappeared about 80 kilometers north of the capital. The search was suspended overnight. It resumed in the morning, hampered by rain in the area.
According to the World Health Organization, there are more than 50 confirmed, probable, or suspected cases of Ebola in the DRC, including 25 deaths. However, health authorities are optimistic that the outbreak will be far more contained than in 2014, when official response was slow and thousands died in West Africa. There was no vaccine until late in that epidemic. To find out more about current prevention strategies and how they compare with the 2014 Ebola outbreak, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Stephen Morse, professor of epidemiology at the Mailman School of Public Health at the Columbia University Medical Center in New York.
One tremendous difference since 2014 was the development of a vaccine. In this case, it's being used in a very directed way, what's sometimes called ring vaccination, basically the same strategy that was used in smallpox eradication. So people who are thought to have come in contact with Ebola patients are the first priority for getting the vaccine. Also, healthcare workers, who obviously are going to be needed in any emergency response and are always very much at risk. Essentially, several widening concentric rings of people who are now immunized and hopefully no longer susceptible, no longer able to be infected. And I think this is a sensible way to use what is, you know, after all, going to be not only limited supply, but it's hard to get it to everyone who needs it quickly because some of these areas are fairly isolated. It's always a matter of being one step behind, but hopefully getting there quickly enough to prevent the disease from moving ahead, because it doesn't move that quickly if you can put some barriers in its way. But that's only going to happen if people continue to be vigilant.
And of course, community education is a key element of fighting and even treating Ebola, correct?
That's a very important part of it. And I think one of the biggest missing pieces really in 2014 was community education. There was just, you know, too much effort by people coming from the West with high technology, you know, trying to save lives, good intentions, but obviously this is not going to necessarily play well with local people who already have been through so much and know very little about this except that it's very frightening. And so you really have to educate using local people who are trusted and inform them so they can tell other people how to take the proper precautions, which are mostly hygiene and sanitation, and understand how to recognize cases when they happen, what to do, so they can protect themselves and make sure that anyone who is sick is taken care of.
We've been talking about preventing or containing Ebola. How do you treat Ebola for people who've been unlucky to come down with the virus?
Treatment for Ebola is largely intensive care, and it's very intensive. So one of the biggest things that's been recognized is that it's very dehydrating. All that bleeding internally and externally, vomiting and so on, leads to a tremendous loss of fluid. So rehydration, otherwise it's a matter of essentially keeping someone alive and as well as you possibly can until they recover, hopefully, or they die of the infection. You need something else. Intensive care is so labor-intensive and so resource-intensive that you would like to have something, you know, like a therapeutic, like a drug that you can give people. There have been some experimental therapies that have been developed. They've used antibodies from people who've survived Ebola, not officially, but in ad hoc experiments in the past, but none of them have been available on a widespread basis. So we really don't know. So I think there's cause for optimism, but it also means that we have to keep up our attention and keep up our effort.
That was Dr. Stephen Morris, professor of epidemiology at the Mailman School of Public Health at the Columbia University Medical Center and the author of Emerging Viruses. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips at his office in New York.
Seventeen past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Ethiopia says it will give a swath of land to Eritrea, a move that could ease a 16-year-old border dispute that has repeatedly erupted into open conflict. The executive committee of Ethiopia's ruling coalition said it wants to bring back the long-lost peace of two brother nations and would adhere to the terms of what's called the Algiers Agreement. That deal resulted in a definitive ruling on the border following a lengthy war. The international community backed the ruling, which was finalized in 2002, and both sides agreed to a UN Boundary Commission's terms. But Ethiopia and Eritrea still disputed nearly three-fourths of the border. The town of Badame became a major flashpoint. The commission awarded it to Eritrea, but Ethiopia refused to cede it. Now, Ethiopia says it is handing over the area and will fully accept and implement the agreement with Eritrea, its former province, which gained independence in 1991. Ethiopia's new Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, vowed in his inaugural address to seek peace with Eritrea.
The ruling party ZANU-PF rallied in Zimbabwe's capital Harare today, a day after a march by the main opposition alliance. Both groups are trying to build support ahead of July's elections. Reporter Kuzai Zvenovashi has details.
Godfrey Tsenengamu is ZANU-PF's youth national commissar.
Today's gathering has been about the youth reaffirming the position of the president, showing solidarity with the president in calling for peace and also promoting non-violence towards elections.
Although hundreds of ZANU-PF supporters came out Wednesday, the rally did not compare to the bumper crowd of opposition supporters that marched Tuesday. Critics say ZANU-PF's event was meant to counter the MDC alliance march. Tsenengamu disagrees.
Ours was a program on its own, which is not a counter. And like I said on stage, we are also going to organize provincial marches for peace. So MDC has not organized anything of that sort in the provinces. Theirs was a national march by the whole party. Ours was a provincial program, not by the whole party, but by a youth league, a wing of the party. And we managed to pull numbers.
Tsenengamo says, ZANU-PF is confident ahead of the July 30th election because the MDC is focusing on the electoral process instead of advancing a clear program.
They've not been saying anything about reforms. They didn't push for any reforms. They are aware that they are going to lose this election, but they would want to get an excuse as to why they lost.
This is the country's first election without former President Robert Mugabe. The military pushed him out of office last year after 37 years of rule. And his successor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, has promised a fair, peaceful election. The MDC alliance also lost its leader this year when founder Morgan Tsvangirai died of cancer. Since then, the alliance has struggled with factionalism. However, members have been united in complaints that government has not been transparent in setting up the election and opening voters' rolls for inspection. Violence by both ZANU-PF and MDC supporters has marred past elections. This year, however, leaders on both sides have preached peace. Thus far, most party members appear to be following that call. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
French President Emmanuel Macron achieved a political breakthrough last week when he brought together the main Libyan actors to agree to hold elections by the end of this year. It was the first time Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar, the Libyan National Army commander, Faiz al-Sarj, the head of the UN-backed government in Tripoli, Akila Saleh, the head of the House of Representatives, and Khalid al-Masri, the head of the State Council, all met and backed steps to unite Libya. However, Haftar continues his military campaign against Islamists in the eastern city of Darna. Ibrahim Haba is a Libyan political analyst. He says the campaign is a double-edged sword. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I believe, get rid of those radical groups, it's helpful. I think it's going to lead to more peaceful country. But we need to include all parties or political party. If we exclude some of those political parties, that might lead to more violence, I believe. So we need a comprehensive political system that includes everybody in order to ensure that democratization is in place. But it seems to me that Khalifa Haftar doesn't believe in power sharing or including those Islamic parties or including Brotherhood and others. But there are some Islamic groups, they are not interested in political or democratic system, and they are just want to establish their agenda there, the Islamic State like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda. Those groups, I believe, they should not be getting a chance to control any part of Libya.
An official source in the U.S. Africa Command, or AFRICOM, had said in a statement to Al-Sharq Al-Awsat newspaper in London that participation by U.S. forces in securing the upcoming presidential and parliamentary elections in Libya might be feasible if Libyan authorities ask for AFRICOM's support. Would the Libyan people support such requests to secure the elections?
It is really hard to say that. I am not sure if U.S. is willing to send a troop to Libya in order to help Libyan people to conduct their election. But in general, I would say that Libyan will welcome a U.S. Air Force to support the Libyan army. As we know, there are many challenges in Libya. There are some states still specific. For example, Tripoli is still under control of the armed militia, and the war can be escalated any time. So I think Libyan people will welcome U.S. help, but I'm not sure if they will accept troops on the ground or U.S. also is willing to send a troop in Libya.
So what's the alternative for Libya if the Paris Agreement failed?
I think the alternative is going to be more civil war or more conflict in Libya between different political parties. Still, there are a lot of challenges. For example, they need a new constitution. There are disagreements about the draft of the constitution. And also they need an electoral law. And also there are disagreements among political parties about the electoral law. And they need also an amendment of the Libyan political agreement in order to go forward for a new election. And also, unfortunately, they did, I think, one thing that seemed to me very bad, which is they attempt to change the political system itself. That is, as people know, that the political system in Libya right now is a parliamentary system. And they aim now to change it to a presidential system, which would lead to go back to an authoritarian system, I believe. Because they have no experience in democracy, and I believe whoever who will be elected for president will be the next dictator.
That was Ibrahim Haba, a Libyan political analyst, speaking with our colleague Mohammed Al-Shinawi.
The U.S. Department of Defense says it carried out airstrikes today at Bani Walid, Libya, that killed four Islamic State militants. The announcement says the strikes were coordinated with the Libyan government of national accord. The news came just shortly after the UN Security Council endorsed Libya's plan to hold national elections in December, a key step toward ending the violence that has divided the country since 2011. The council issued a statement urging all Libyans to work together to ensure that the required technical, legislative, political, and security conditions are in place. Those include a new round of voter registration, appropriate funding and security arrangements, required electoral legislation, and meaningful and equal participation of women in the political process. It is also called for improving the atmosphere for the presidential and parliamentary vote by working toward the unification of the military, security forces, and economic institutions. The Council also welcomed the momentum that it said was created at the International Conference on Libya in France last week.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yahya Suhaib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we look at the heroic rescue of a child by a migrant from Mali and examine the forces that pushed him out of Africa and into Europe. What are the factors that propel people to leave their country? And why is Europe such an alluring destination? On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on The Voice of America. bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best.
Yes, sir. Two-Face. Nato C. Hey.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.